You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, everyone, very excited about today's episode. We are getting the opportunity to speak with Rob Berger. And for many of you, you may be familiar with Rob as he was the founder of DoughRoller.net, started in 2007. I mean, really has been with that site for a long time and seen incredible growth. Now he's taking on a new project and he's writing over at retirebeforemomanddad.com. And he has a new book with the same title. And honestly, if you were to pull back the covers, which you're going to do a little bit of today, you'll find that really this is the simple numbers behind a lifetime of financial freedom. And honestly, it is a wonderful intro into these general principles that will act as a forcing function for a fantastic financial life. And excited to find out a little bit more about Rob's origin story and really pull out some of these big components, these big ideas that are encapsulated in this book and turn that into a conversation. Help me with this. I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I'm doing quite well. And yeah, you're absolutely right. Rob's story has a little bit of everything. He started practicing law. He started DoughRoller as a hobby. He sold the website DoughRoller after that. Now he's a deputy editor at Forbes. He has this book. And he's been a longstanding member of the personal finance community. And honestly, selfishly, I've never had a chance to speak with him. This was a genuinely good book. I went through it, and I love the fact the simple numbers. I think we're going to get a chance to really dive into this, look at it almost as a 5-101. Go back to the basics, understand the components of compounding and how it impacts your financial independence. So with that, Rob, welcome to the Choose FI podcast.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
So Rob, you do not, I don't believe you have a degree at this point in personal finance. Like Brad and myself, this was something that maybe you learned selfishly, you know, to do better with your own finances. I'm curious if you go back, you're practicing law, you're finding yourself on the hedonic treadmill, tackle some of these themes in your story. What was that inflection point for you where you realized you really needed to spend some time focusing on this concept of personal finance?
I'll give you the short answer, I suppose, and then happy to dive into it. But you know, I was following the sort of law partner way of thinking about money. So I'd worked 8 years at a big law firm in DC. I made partner and I did what partners do. I bought a fancy car, bought a fancy watch, joined a country club. And one morning, just shortly after all of that, it was about a 2-year time period, I woke up and I realized I was trying to emulate my father, who basically, although he died at a young age, that was the lifestyle he had. It was very clear to me it wasn't what I wanted. And I didn't want to be a partner. Like I didn't want any of it. Like after 2 years of being a partner and the firm was wonderful, I left the partnership, took a 6-figure pay cut, got rid of the fancy country club, which by the way is now owned by Donald Trump. Whole story there. Anyway,
sidebar.
Yeah, it was Lowe's Island when I belonged to it, a country club here in Northern Virginia on the Potomac River, beautiful country club, 36 holes. And I guess he bought it, I don't know when, it was after I left. And of course, he renamed it Trump International.
It's got a certain ring to it.
But yeah, so I got rid of that. I got rid of the fancy watch. And it was really just born out of this idea that none of that stuff, and there's nothing wrong with that if others make those choices, but it just wasn't what was making me happy. So that kind of led me to 2005 when, in fact, I still got the piece of paper. It's over there on the shelf. But I wrote a note to myself. I said, in 7 years, I had the exact date, I'm going to be totally debt-free. Yeah, and that just started me down to a path that eventually led me to be on the Choose FI podcast. And
The culmination.
Yeah, well, I actually want to talk about that. So in 7 years, I want to be debt-free. So what sort of debt are we talking about? Because you had it made. You're a law partner, man. You're crushing it.
Yeah. So we always saved some money. We never had the kind of debt where, you know, we were teetering on bankruptcy or anything like that. But, you know, we had the mortgage and we had a home equity line of credit. I think in 05, I still had some school loans and my wife did. So we were probably looking at, I don't even know if I want to say the number out loud, but it was certainly high 6 figures in total debt, including the mortgage.
And you just took a six-figure pay cut.
And just a couple of years earlier, I'd taken a six-figure pay cut. So I was trying to figure out, how can I make this as hard on me as possible?
Oh, man. Rob, I want to dive into the psychology of this for a couple of minutes here. So basically, your entire life at that point had led you to being a partner at a law firm. You went to law school. I assume at the earliest, you graduated around 25. You said 8 years at this firm. So you're 33 at the youngest. And you had all the trappings. Like you said, country club, the watch, the car, all this stuff. I can't imagine it was just like on a whim, you decided to unravel it all. What caused that awakening? Was there some external force? Was it something you had been mulling over for years? Were there conversations with loved ones? Talk me through how that actually occurs.
So the first thing, as I alluded to, was the things that I had bought, they weren't making me happy. Happiness wasn't coming from the country club. In fact, I would join this expensive country club and I would end up playing more often at other courses because none of my friends could join the country club. So, and it was too expensive to bring them as a guest. So we would go to their golf course. We'd play there. I'd play at other places more than the country club. But anyway, yeah, this stuff wasn't making me happy. So that was sort of one part of it. And the other part was I looked at partners at the firm, and this is an international firm, 1,000 lawyers. Those that were 10 or 20 or even 30 years older than I was, they weren't, for the most part, they weren't all that happy. It's not that there weren't some that were, but you know, they struggled to, even in the context of a big firm, they struggled to find their place and to continue to do well and thrive. I thought, you know, we've got one life to live, and I just don't think I want to go down that route and make my entire life about big law. It's funny, looking back on it, it doesn't seem that risky to me, but I know it sounds crazy to actually make that decision. But at the time, my wife's very supportive. She was not into the law partner lifestyle. She didn't care about the country club or anything like that. So that helped a lot.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had a similar thought process and awakening. I was in public accounting, albeit I had this realization at maybe 23. So I'd only been working there for a year. But similar to you, I looked around at the partners and right at these law firms, these accounting firms, being a partner or managing director at an investment bank, this is the carrot, right? This is what they tell you from day one. If you're really lucky, there's this funnel. Whatever X percent of you are going to make it, it's going to be sub 5%. But the carrot is you get to make all this money. There's something to that, I suppose. But I looked around and I looked at these partners and they were working the same 80-hour weeks that I was, right? It was 2 a.m. right before tax deadline and the partner was sitting there collating tax returns with me. This was the carrot? Right. It's insane.
Well, you get a watch too, Brad.
Yeah, I guess. And a country club. But fortunately, I did find that. And I'm curious, have you seen other people have that realization or is it just so indoctrinated in your fellow lawyers, I guess, that this is the path? Have you seen other people step off the path?
Oh, sure. Most of them are smarter than I am, and they do it sooner. They don't. I mean, it is probably unusual for most folks to suffer through, and I shouldn't say that. There was a lot about my law career that I enjoyed, but to work the kind of hours you have to for 8 years to make partner and only then leave it. Most folks, particularly in the DC area, leave much sooner than that. Maybe they go into government, maybe in-house. But yeah, it's not uncommon. Practicing law is not, there's some glamour to it, I suppose. And I worked on some very interesting cases and some very public cases. Defended some politicians and was involved in the Ruby Ridge shooting matter, which happened a while ago, involved the FBI. But it's a tough life. And so, yeah, there's a lot of folks that tap out early.
You know, it's interesting. As you are both discussing this, I'm actually remembering in my job in pharmacy, I was also looking at those that were 20 or 30 years ahead of me and saying, you look miserable. I better have an escape plan because I don't want to look miserable 20 or 30 years from now. You know what I mean? Like you got to, no matter what industry you're in, that's actually, there's something there. There's a pattern there and you don't necessarily have to leave your job, but you should always be thinking about options. If you see everybody that has 10 additional years invested and they basically feel like they're just treading water, just kind of note when you see these patterns, note that. Rob, I want to come back to your situation. And we have this very interesting financial goal and dilemma that you have, right? You've walked away from a six-figure income, or rather even maybe even worse than that, you've taken a six-figure pay cut on top of that, you have this awesome goal of paying off multiple six figures in debt, including your mortgage, but multiple six figures in debt, and do it in a period of like 7 years. Now, we're talking about personal finance today, and we're talking about in the context of this book that you wrote, which is kind of taking some of those big principles and distilling it into an action plan. I'm curious what portion of what is in this book is actually reflected in the choices that you made early on when you left your practice.
Pretty much all of it, honestly. The first step when I decided I wanted to become debt free, and by the way, there was no real magic or even math behind the 7 years. Mathematically, I should say, it didn't seem feasible. And in fact, we failed. It took us longer than 7 years. There was no sort of magic, really. But the first thing that we did, as simple as this is I just made a commitment to no more debt, period. When I made that decision, I immediately went out and paid off a car loan that we had just acquired. We had the money to pay it, so I paid it. You know, I can remember going to shop for furniture for a dining room, and they were going to offer us a 0%. I'm all for 0% balance transfers. We use those extensively to get out of debt. But I was concerned that using 0% to finance a new purchase would cause us to buy more. So I said, no, thank you to that. And we just stopped borrowing more money. That was the first thing. And the second thing was, and I alluded to this earlier, I started to get rid of unnecessary expenses. And it's not that we cut our budget to the bone, but for example, I got rid of the country club, seems like an obvious place to start. And eventually, let's see, around that time, I got rid of one of our nice cars. Today, my wife owns a car. I don't own a car. But in any event, eventually sold the fancy watch that I bought. So we made decisions like that, that one, kept us from going into more debt, and two, freed up money in our budget so that we could tackle our debt. And I just started month to month. You know, I took advantage of every 0% offer I could find. I transferred some debt to our home equity line of credit, which has risks and is not for everybody, but it was a very low interest rate, and just started chipping away at the debt. One thing I'll say, and this is a point I make in the book, and I think it's critical, I continued to invest. So I'm not a believer in pay off all your non-mortgage debt before you start investing. In fact, I think that's got to be, I think, the worst financial advice I've heard. It certainly is in the top five. And we didn't do that. We continued to invest in our 401k. And I got at that point, I had a match from the employer. So we weren't doing anything that to me is beyond sort of normal, typical stuff you should be doing. We were just being smarter with our money.
So, Rob, I'm curious on this line of delineation, ultimately. You said you don't want to get into more debt, but we're talking 0% on that furniture in this case. I guess I'm curious about prioritization and how you advise people, right? Because you're saying to keep investing as well. For people who maybe follow Dave Ramsey, who you've mentioned multiple times in the book, there are a lot of different messages, ultimately, which are pay down everything, don't invest. But yet, you know, people like us, we talk about 401k match. If you're not putting in up until your 401k match, you're throwing away money in essence, right? That's part of your salary that you're not receiving. But yet, on the other hand, you passed up a chance for 0% interest. I'm curious just like the interplay of all this stuff. And I'm sorry, this is a bit of a rambling question, but I think you get a sense of where I'm going here. A lot of people just don't know how to prioritize. And I'm curious if you could give some advice to them.
So I always start with where I want to end up, the end goal. And for me, the ultimate goal was not actually being debt-free. The ultimate goal was financial freedom. Now, you know, we can talk about how you define that mathematically. I know in the book, and I know, I'm sure it's you've talked many times on your show about the 4% rule or 25 times your expenses. But however you define it, the end goal for me was financial freedom. You don't actually have to be debt-free to have financial freedom. I think it's a big and important part of that. So I always keep my eye on what my ultimate goal is. My ultimate goal isn't to pay off all my debt. That may be part of it. But the ultimate goal is financial freedom. And if that's my ultimate goal, then skipping an employer match on a 401k to pay off a 5% student loan or worse, a 0% on a credit card, to me, you know, it's like the dumbest thing ever. I mean, just to put it out there.
How do you really feel, Rob? And,
yeah. Well, and I think it comes into focus, again, if you keep your eye on your ultimate goal, which is financial freedom. So the other thing is, you know, we can multitask. It's not as if we're only allowed to have one financial goal at a time. You know, you can have two or three if you want. There's no rule against that. And so that's what we did. And in terms of the 0% on the furniture, so two thoughts there. The first is, I don't want to take on financing if I think it's going to cause me, if it's going to influence my purchasing decision. And I was concerned that I'd be more inclined to buy more furniture or more expensive furniture than we would if we were taking the money out of the bank account. So that's sort of a, I guess, a behavioral finance issue. The second thing is that, you know, 0% for, I think it was for 12 months, you know, what kind of interest are we going to earn on this money for that 12? I mean, how much are we really saving? Yeah, it's not that much. It's not going to move the needle. Again, if you're focused on your ultimate goal, financial freedom, I mean, I'm a big believer in really making the most out of every single dollar. So I don't want to suggest that I'm frivolous with money, but the money that we would save didn't seem to me to be worth the risk that we would buy whatever, $5,000 worth of furniture instead of three. I don't actually remember what we spent, but I didn't want to take that risk. And I'm not really as dogmatic, I guess, on some things as maybe Dave Ramsey is, but in this case, it seemed to me smart to simply say, that's it, no new debt.
It's interesting. Yeah. I have similar feelings when it comes to financing stuff, especially small items. Maybe they're relatively large purchases, but in the scheme of things, we're not talking about a house. We're not talking about a car. We're talking about a couch. We're talking about blinds. We're talking about right. like these frivolous items. You're like, oh, I can afford the payments. And as soon as you start to have any sort of mentality around, oh, I can afford the payments, something has gone off the rails. I kind of line up pretty closely with you on that. But I'm curious, like, as you're building like a framework for your actions here, you started with assessing your debt, right? And then not taking on new debt. It's kind of, all right, fine, here's what we have, and we're not going to take on more. We have this goal of financial freedom. We realize the first thing we want to do is really start figuring out how we want to tackle this debt. And I'm curious, and you know, there's different ways of tackling your debt, and you have this mortgage. Maybe you had some student loans. You had some car loans. You know, like, how long did it take you to really put your plan together, and what approach did you take in terms of, did you look at the interest rates, and or did you look at the balance? Like, how did you go about actually tackling these debts?
So the first thing, and I know this whole debt snowball, debt avalanche debate. So the first thing I did was I got the lowest interest rates I possibly could on all the debts. We refinanced our mortgage. I think we ended up refinancing it twice. I actually got a lower rate on my home equity line of credit just by calling them. I'm not sure if you can even do that today, but we did. And we transferred as much as we could to zero balance transfer cards. When those expired after a year or year and a half, whatever the term was, we would just roll them over to a new 0% balance transfer card. Now, in terms of like which debts we tackled first, I generally lean to the debt avalanche where you tackle your highest interest rate debt first. Although I certainly think there's a place for the debt snowball depending on your specific circumstances. In our case, other than the 0% credit cards, it was all really low interest rate debt. So one of the factors I looked at that I don't hear many people talk about is not interest rate or balance, but the type of debt that I'm paying off. And what I mean by that is I was much more comfortable paying off the home equity line of credit in chunks because if an emergency happened, I could borrow again. Again, my plan was not to borrow, but I always like to, you know, you hope for the best, prepare for the worst. So if I pay down, let's say, a student loan, well, the money's gone. I can never ask for it back from the student loan servicer, right? It's an installment loan, just like a car loan. But if I pay off a home equity line of credit or some other revolving credit, and I need more money down the road, I can always go back and access it again. We looked at that too, and I was much more comfortable when we found some extra money to put towards debt, to put it towards the home equity line of credit first.
That's interesting because you use the word emergency in that statement in terms of what actually, how that informed what you chose to pay off first. And now I'm curious, you know, as you're doing this, I mean, I think you guys had some net worth, you know, you weren't at financial freedom at this particular point in time. And you have, I guess your net worth, when you look at your debt, probably dragged you back, but you had some net worth. And I'm curious for you, your finances probably at this point in time wouldn't be described as a dumpster fire. You were doing pretty well comparatively, right? How did that change your approach to actually an emergency fund?
That's a great question. So we basically didn't have one. And my thinking there again was, so there's two kinds of emergencies, I think, of financially, right? There's the car breaks down or the furnace goes out, an expense emergency. And for all of those, we would have been able to deal with it. And again, my goal was no more debt, but if I had to, if it was some extra debt on the credit card versus not having, keeping my family warm in the winter, I'll take on more debt. So we could handle that kind of emergency with borrowing if we had to. And the other kind of financial emergency is on the income side, right? You lose your job. And I felt, given my background and where we live and the job opportunities, that that wasn't a significant risk. Or if I did lose my job, I would find another one very quickly. No guarantee of that, but I felt comfortable enough with that. I mean, we might have had a few hundred dollars in the savings account, but really for a number of years, not much at all, because I wanted to put it all towards the debt.
That's really interesting. And I got to say that I'm very comfortable, but at the same time, I recognize that that's very situational. This is why it's a very nuanced game. And you have to realize, Rob, your risk tolerance is maybe different than someone else's risk tolerance. We just said your finances were not a dumpster fire. You were not in a financial emergency. In fact, if anything, your biggest danger was just complacency. So to be able to see that and then say, all right, how does that, what would I do if the income emergency happened or the expense emergency happened, to be able to say, oh, I have a plan for that. To some degree, I understand why you came to the conclusion, I need less of emergency fund, like sitting in a checking account, making 0.01%. It's not to say you don't have money that you can't. And the reason I want to point this out to people is that the alternative path is, hey, before you ever invest a dollar, you need to have a fully funded 3 to 6 month emergency. You need to have 6 months of expenses before you start investing anything. And then how long does that actually keep you out of the market actually investing? I love, you know, I'm just kind of doing the setup here, but I'd love to hear you kind of work through that as well. What's your take on that?
Well, it's funny. It's changed over time. So today, fast forward 15 years, we have enough cash in the bank to live on for a couple of years. But of course, I'm not tackling debt anymore. We don't have any debt. Although an argument could be made that we have too much cash. And it's something that I think about regularly. The key here is to understand that there's no one right answer that's going to apply to for everyone. In my case, I was a lawyer. I'd been a partner. I was now in house and I was living and working, for better or worse, in an area of the country that has far more lawyers than sometimes I think we need. But the point is, jobs are plentiful for lawyers. You can go to the government. And so I had a lot of options. Now, what if I grew up in the Midwest? So what if, rather than being a lawyer in D.C., I worked, I was a union employee at a manufacturing company in a small town in the Midwest, and it was basically the only job going in that town. And if I lost my job, I'd really be hurting. Well, I might come out of that with a different answer, you know, in terms of paying down my debt. So it's just not a one size fits all kind of question. And in my case, it sounds risky, maybe, not to have much of an emergency fund. But the reality is, I don't think it was much risk at all. And sure, I could have put 3 to 6 months of spending aside. But frankly, if I'd lost my job and I needed 3 to 6 months of spending, I could have accessed it on the home equity line of credit. Yes, in theory, they could cancel the home equity line of credit. So again, there's always risks. But it didn't feel like a significant risk to me then. And frankly, looking back on it now, it doesn't either.
Rob, you mentioned you have a couple years of cash in savings now. Was this an overt decision? Is it something that just kind of crept up? Are we talking like market timing? What's going on behind having that much cash sitting around?
It's definitely not market timing. I predicted, by the way, that interest rates would go back up in 2010. So that tells you how good I am at predicting the market. So it's a combination of selling my business and putting capital to work. By and large, I'm a big believer in index fund investing, although I do own 15% of our portfolio in stocks. Happy to talk about that if you want. But part of the cash is because we recently moved and I wasn't sure how much we would need for that move and for anything we would do with the new home. And we're working through that now. So once we work through that over the next couple of months, I suspect we'll end up with a lot less cash. Although the cash that we do have will likely go into an intermediate term bond fund. And yeah, so I guess it still will stay fixed income, but that's part of a bigger asset allocation plan. Again, happy to dive into details on that if you want.
No, that's interesting. And I actually, since we're talking about cash, you mentioned before behavioral finance, right? And you were talking in terms of, okay, I can get this 0% interest loan on furniture, but I suspect it will cause us to spend more. Now, where I normally hear that line of reasoning is with cash versus credit cards. I know my family, we put everything on our credit card. We try to earn rewards points to travel and pay it off on time and in full every single month. And in my mind, I think I'm doing the right thing. But since I can't prove what I would spend if I used with cash, since I've never undertaken that exercise, I simply don't know. I like to believe that we don't spend more, but
I can't imagine you spending less.
Yeah. But I'm curious where you come down on this, maybe now and also at the beginning of this 7-year journey.
Yeah, so I'm a big believer in credit cards and cash back and travel rewards. In fact, I just got a great new card from Alliant Credit Union outside of Chicago that pays 3% on everything the first year and 2.5% after that. So a couple of thoughts there. The first is most of the purchases we make with a credit card, we physically can't buy more than we do. Like I can't put more than a tank of gas in my car, even if I wanted to. And that's true whether I pay with cash or the credit card. And I'm not going to, you know, all my utilities that I put on a credit card, they are what they are. Yes, discretionary spending, clothes and things like that, I suppose folks arguably could spend more. But if you're paying your balance off in full every month, I think that's a big limiting factor in terms of just spending crazy money. Part of it too is, you know, we've just been at this long enough. You know, we kind of know our monthly routine. We don't really spend a lot of money day to day. I'll spend more on my home than I will. We don't eat out a lot. You can obviously tell I don't spend a lot of money on clothes or for that matter, a haircut now that I'm looking at myself. It's a risk, I think. Maybe I'm fooling myself, but it's a risk I think I can manage.
I want to circle back to, we're kind of using these choices that you made over the last decade or so to kind of walk through, I think, a game plan that many of us have to implement for our lives. So first, there's that wake up, there's that decision, there's that action, there's that early kind of unformed action, but like it's moving us in the right direction. A lot of times it involves cleaning up debt or having a plan for our debt or even having a plan to not handle our debt, but some sort of a plan. But now you just mentioned your investing strategy, and I'm curious. And we landed on index funds as well. For you, what drew you to that strategy and what is your philosophy behind that?
So when I started, I didn't know a thing. Neither of my parents sort of were investors, didn't teach me anything about investing. And I went to a bank, First Union, been acquired since then. And I bought a front-loaded, expensive fund. I don't even know what it invested in. And didn't know what I was doing. And I just started reading. Rick Ferry's book, Asset Allocation, was a big thing for me back in the day. And I just started reading, and I did invest in some actively managed funds. And one of them was famed investor Bill Miller, Legg Mason Value Trust. And it's famous for having beaten the S&P 500, I want to say for 15 years. But then, of course, it eventually cratered. I invested in that fund based on coworkers' suggestion and was doing very well. I looked at the fund after about 5 years. It was still doing great. And I thought, you know, the day is going to come when this underperforms the market. I don't know when, I don't know for how long or by how much, but it's going to happen. Will I be able to stick with my investing plan and stick with this fund when it underperforms the market for 1 year, for 3 years, for 5 years? And I ultimately concluded that no, I probably won't. I'll start to question management of that fund. And if I can't stick to that investment for the next 50 years, and that's how I think about investing, I have no business being in it. And that led me to index funds. And folks like Rick Ferry and others, and you know, the Bogleheads. Just to add a little more detail, when I first got in index fund investing, I wanted like, you know, 37 different asset classes. I mean, I had, you know, some crazy idea about how I wanted to invest in every possible asset class and looked at a lot of different funds. Over time, I've gotten to the point where, yeah, that really doesn't matter. I mean, it sounds good on paper, but a 3-fund portfolio is fine. My standard portfolio has 6 funds. I think a low cost, and they're not all low cost, but a low cost target date retirement fund is good. But the key is, I think index funds give folks, they make it easy, but it makes it easier to stick to your plan because when they're down, you know it's not because the fund managers have lost their touch or made some huge mistake. It's because the market is down. And that's just going to happen. And you add in that costs that are usually under 10 basis points. Heck, today, some funds are free. I just think, at least for the core of a portfolio, it's the smartest way to go.
Yeah, I used some terminology we'll come back to in just a second. But I actually wanted to talk about, because you have had so many index funds, you've tracked so many indexes, you know, picking that one. And you kind of said now you personally are kind of on this 6-fund strategy. The 3-fund would be fine. You know, simple is better. To distill that for audience, I am curious about maybe asking your opinion on cap weighting versus weighting asset classes. You know, so like with the S&P 500, just for audience, you have the vast majority of those holdings, although you may own 500 companies, or in the case of VTSAX, 3,000 some odd companies, the vast majority of those holdings are cap weighted towards the largest, right? Which has been carried by growth. And so if you were to then, we've talked to Paul Merriman, and Paul Merriman has talked about value and basically saying, hey, would it be nice to own everything equally? Which, yeah, you're tracking an index, but you're tracking the index kind of differently. And I'm curious your thoughts on where you kind of fall on that, how much you've thought you've put into that.
The theory, at least in part, behind index fund investing is that you're going to mirror the market, right? That's the idea. You're not going to try to outsmart it. So if you want to mirror the market, you have to go cap weighted, right? Because that's the market. Now, there's a limitation. We can't really mirror the market, right? I mean, for starters, most of the market is in privately held companies, but we can at least try to mirror the public markets pretty well. And so it would have to be cap weighted. You know, if you go the other way, as you mentioned, Paul Merriman, he's a good friend of mine. If you want to go the other route, it's the effect will be that you'll be investing more in, say, smaller and mid-cap companies, right? Well, a simple way to do that, and this is part of my 6-fund portfolio, is that I'll invest typically 10%, let's say, in a small cap value fund. So it doesn't accomplish the exact same thing, but it moves the needle closer to weighting more small cap and value. One important question is, well, will that make a difference? Will I be better off? And there's only one answer to that. We have no idea. If you get any other answer to that question.
Ask me in 50 years.
Yeah, that's the only answer. I mean, we can certainly look at history and say, well, over time, small cap value does do better. So do emerging markets long term. And so I think we're justified in putting some extra money in those funds, for example, if we want to. But we have to keep in mind that there's no way to know that our outcome will be better.
So Rob, for the listeners out there who are basically waiting on bated breath here, the 6-fund strategy, can you just give a quick high-level overview of what would make that up? And I assume you have an article about this. We could probably put that in the show notes.
Okay, I'll see if I can dig up an article. I probably do. But it's, you know, it's large U.S. companies, right? And then small cap value would be the second one. And then an international fund, an emerging market fund. So usually I do 10% in small cap value, 10% in emerging market. And then a roughly equal split between large U.S. companies and developed country companies, probably leaning more towards U.S. companies a bit. And then 10% in a REIT. Always have your REITs in a retirement account, right? Because they're not tax friendly. And then the 6th fund for me would be a bond fund. And I usually just go with like a Vanguard intermediate term bond fund.
I have one additional question for you in terms of, you know, stocks versus bonds. So somewhat, you know, different people are reading this book. Some people are trying to retire before mom and dad, right? So they are doing this at a younger age and maybe in their 20s and 30s. They're thinking like, do I need any bonds in my portfolio this time? We hear about, you know, these target date funds that have some and taper forward. I've heard of 100% equity allocations, and you know, I have a 40-year timeline and I'm just going to set and forget. What are your thoughts on, obviously it's one thing as you're getting closer to drawdown, but another for that person that's just starting out at the beginning of their 40-year investing journey?
Yeah, if someone's just starting out, I have no problem with 100% stock portfolio. They just have to realize that they could lose 50%. I mean, in theory, you could lose more, but when you're just starting out, you know, there's one thing to lose 50% of $10,000, and it's another thing to lose 50% of $2 million. And so we were talking to my sister, and she was just she's much younger than I am, starting to contribute to a retirement account. And I said, yeah, just put it all in the S&P 500 index fund. And over time, you'll want to make some changes, and we can talk about that. The reality is that the difference between 100% stock portfolio and say a 90-10 or even 80-20, particularly when you're young and just starting out, I'm fine. I would not object if my children wanted to be 100% stock index fund at this point.
Well, I am curious about talking about at what point, you know, let's say that individual took that advice and they're just 100% and they're happy with it. In fact, they have $30,000, $40,000 invested and the market just dropped 50%. Yep. Because they're thinking this way. They're like, yes, I didn't lose 50%. Just going forward, I'm buying it for 50% off. This is fantastic. Best thing ever. You know, what if you could have that mindset? How rich would you be? But play that forward. And now you're at the point where you need to start thinking about some of these, you know, these other, I guess, asset classes or stock to bond ratios. At what point are you starting to say, let's circle back to that. Let's readdress that allocation.
When they're 32 and a half.
Oh, it's good. That's good. Yeah. When you can give absolutes, now we're talking, right?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it actually comes up in a lot of different scenarios. One is the bucket strategy for retirement. I don't know if you've covered that before, but it's fine in theory. But then you still have to ask the question, well, when do I start moving money from bucket to bucket, right? So there's no hard and fast rule. Part of it's going to depend on the individual. You know, if you think about it, when you're 20, and let's just assume you're going to retire at 60 for the sake of discussion, you've got 40 years. Okay, well, now you're 30. You've got 30 years. Is there really much of a difference from an investing perspective? I think one could argue no. What is different is you've got more money, number one, and your risk tolerance will change. Your risk tolerance will absolutely change over time. Some think it will go down because you sort of learn the ropes. Maybe you've gone through a bear market. You've paid your dues. Maybe you survived it and didn't sell. But the reality is, I'm speaking from personal experience, as you get older, your risk tolerance goes down. And it's not just because you're going to retire sooner. It's because you have more money at stake. And there's less reason to take risk. Although I think one can make the big argument that bonds right now are riskier than stocks, but that's another discussion. So the
so
short
many other
answer
discussions.
Is,
I feel like we have like five or six discussions teed up, ready
to
go.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Rob will be back on next Friday and every week thereafter at the beginning of spring.
Well, the first answer is there's no answer to the question, right? There's no one answer. One thing that I like to tell folks who aren't of a mind to sort of dive into the literature and just study and read is look at what the target date retirement funds do and see how they change over time. Because you can always, even if you don't choose to invest in a target date retirement fund, you can mirror more or less what they do, particularly in terms of stock bonds. Now, of course, I think if you're in your 20s, they're probably at a 90-10 portfolio, but you could see how they change and use that as sort of your North Star. I don't think you would go wrong there. But the real takeaway is this is as much art as it is science. I think it's important to keep that in mind. It's not like there's just one answer to this kind of question.
I want to come back and talk about core versus maybe the unsaid word, which is maybe satellite. You actually do some individual stock investing. You said that you hold 15% of your portfolio individual stocks. And this is interesting because when we talked with Brian Feraldi, he's a writer with The Motley Fool and a great friend of the FI community. He's actually done a couple guest posts for us, come on the show several times. He was talking about this would be a great, like, not everybody's going to love stocks. Not everybody is going to love learning about individual companies and being able to put the attention and time in to be able to do it. But for those that do, you're never going to get 20,000% returns on your index fund. That's the entire point. We just want to keep up with the market. So, you know, it seems to me like the whole core, which is the core is going to get me to my goal. The satellite being this maybe smallish percentage that I'm keeping at the perimeters gives me a chance to have some fun and get some incredible returns. Maybe that's fair. I'm curious your perspective, why you know, despite having a core that's getting you to where you'd be and using the terms, I just want to keep more of my, I want to take some of my chips off the table. Why are you opening yourself up to more risk with some of these companies?
You know, Todd Tresseter, I think he's been on your show.
Yep.
I was talking to him this summer. We were out in California and we were talking about this. He goes, do you really think you can outsmart the market? And I thought about that question later and I thought, yeah, actually I do think I can outsmart the market because a lot of times the market is really dumb. Long-term it's not, but short-term the market does really dumb things. And so this kind of began back in 2005. I went to work for the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, which is reports up to the SEC. It regulates auditors of publicly traded companies. I was in the enforcement division. And so for 7 years, I was knee deep in financial statements. It's all I did day in and day out. I kind of liked it. Most people probably wouldn't. But that really got me interested in sort of fundamental analysis of financial statements and companies. And so that kind of led me to some investments. One of the first was Berkshire Hathaway. Honestly, the main reason to invest there was so that I could go to the annual meetings. And I've taken my wife, our daughter, our son at different times. And that's just been a wonderful experience, a lot of fun. And then that kind of branched out. And I only own, I have 15% of our portfolio in basically four companies. So it's a very focused portfolio, but they're all sort of blue chip other than Berkshire. They're all dividend paying stocks. And I was able to buy them when I thought the market was kind of going haywire. Apple is one of them. I don't regularly invest in Apple, but every now and again, they sell like, you know, a million fewer iPhones than people were expecting, and the market craters on Apple. I think, I don't think the market is very smart right now, and I invest in Apple. Could I ultimately be, I guess, wrong on some of these? Sure, but I don't think in a way that's going, remember, the ultimate goal is financial freedom, and another goal is to have fun, I guess. So for me, investing in individual stocks is fun. I think the risk of it actually hurting us in terms of our ultimate goal, both because of the companies we've invested in and the amount we've invested, is minimal best. So that's what I've done. And I enjoy it. I actually think, well, I can tell you that it has increased our overall returns so far. And I've been investing in individual stocks for about a decade. Will it long-term? Of course, there's no way to know. But I do think the other thing is it's actually decreased our volatility a little bit of our portfolio. I couldn't put a mathematical number to that because I haven't calculated it. But just from what I've seen, I'm pretty sure our to get into the tech speak, the standard deviation of our returns is lower because of the individual stocks that we own. And that's maybe that I use that to justify my insanity, I guess.
Rob, you mentioned in there that most of your stocks are dividend paying stocks. Was that an overt decision? Is this an income play? Is it part of that larger overall goal of financial freedom? Talk us through that.
So dividends are a bad deal for investors. You don't want dividends. And that's true even if you're in retirement. I know there's all kinds of talk about dividend investing. And I think it hurts us. And it hurts us for a lot of reasons. Certainly in a taxable account, it's because it hurts for a couple of reasons. One, you have no control over when you get paid. The company decides for you. And if you're in a taxable account, it gets taxed, right? And there are some other things more technical things that it can cause that you'd be better off in a Berkshire situation where you just, if you want money, you sell a share, right? And actually Warren Buffett, I think it was in his 2015 newsletter, but I could have the year wrong.
You and Brad are the only two people in my life that routinely quote what year Warren Buffett quoted something in his annual newsletter.
I'm sure that it's just the three of us now that are still listening to this podcast. Everyone else is.
You said standard deviations and they hit snooze. Done.
Yeah. Anyway, he has a great discussion on why you'd be much better off not having dividends and just selling stock when you need your money. In any event, the reason though that I focus on dividend paying stock is not necessarily because of the dividend. There is one nice thing about dividends, and that is when the market's down, assuming the dividend hasn't gone away, and sometimes that happens, right? Auto industry, banking in 08. But if the dividend hasn't gone away, it kind of helps steady the ship a little bit. Not a lot, but a little bit. But the reason I focus mainly on dividend paying stocks is because I'm focused on a certain type of company. And it's the established company that is what I would consider a value stock. And so Amazon would be the opposite of that, right? Doesn't mean it's a bad investment. I could just never bring myself to invest in Amazon given its price. So I tend to focus on value companies and they almost all pay a dividend. Berkshire is a notable exception.
So let's go ahead and talk about Dough Roller just for a second here, because you can actually do multiple things at once. You can do a little multitasking. You can work on your debt. You can work on investing. You can work on building a side hustle. You know, all these different things. And in fact, you did. And in fact, your side hustle became far more than a side hustle. It was probably one of the highest profile independent personal finance websites over the last decade. And you recently sold it. And I know that, you know, anybody listening to this would probably recognize, if they're familiar with Dough Roller, would say Dough Roller was an incredible site and it was probably worth something that had to contribute towards your financial freedom number. I'm curious, one to ask you, you know, like, is this what got you to financial freedom? And then, or what piece of that was it? And then two, you know, and we can separate these questions out, but I'll ask you just so you know where we're going. Let's talk a little bit about bucket strategy now in terms of now, I think you're not drawing an income from traditional sources. What does that look like?
Okay. You know, I made this decision to focus on finances and get out of debt and focus on financial freedom in 05. That's when I got rid of the country club and all that kind of stuff. And then it was 07 that I started Dough Roller. So we were already 2 years down the path. It wasn't a business. It was just a hobby, but I was very motivated. I have no earthly idea why. And so for the first 2 years of the site, I was still practicing law full time. I'd get up at 5 a.m. 7 days a week, work from 5 to about 7:30. And then I'll work on weekdays, get on the metro here in DC and work on the metro and then work at lunch and then work at night. And I was just driven. And I made like the first 6 months, I made a full $100. So it wasn't exactly profitable to start with. But the thing it did was it kept me super focused on finances, right? And it was a lot of fun. So the first way Dough Roller helped me was just to kind of give me more motivation to continue to hopefully do smart things with our money. Now, over time, it turned into a business, and I wasn't expecting that. And it led me to retiring from law in 2016. You know, in terms of financial freedom, the sale of the site affected affected it, but not in the way you might think. I mean, if you define FI as 25 times your expenses, annual expenses, we'd already reached that before I sold the site. For me, selling the site was oddly enough, not unlike retiring from the law partnership. I enjoyed doing it, loved it for 12 years or however long I had it, 11 years, but just decided I didn't want to do it the rest of my life. And I got a good enough offer and it made sense. And it actually, selling it allowed me to finish the book, retire before mom and dad. So it gave me the freedom now to do other things. So I didn't need to sell the site to have FI, although it didn't hurt. But
might have changed that withdrawal rate.
Yeah. I mean, but it gave me freedom, really the freedom away. I could have just turned the site over to someone else to manage, but I tried that. And I just, maybe it's just not my DNA to do it that way. So selling it just made the most sense.
So I guess the second piece of this is, and this is what I was kind of alluding to, was, are you bringing in any income from traditional jobs at this particular point in time?
So I still do the Doorholder podcast and they pay me a stipend to do that. But I love doing the podcast. And then I work at Forbes as an editor, and that's a paid position. And that wasn't my plan at the time. I thought, okay, I'll do that for a year. And it's been a year and a half. And I enjoy that very much.
So deputy editor at Forbes, that's a very interesting job. And I imagine it's not one that you find an application on Craigslist for. So I'm just curious, what does that mean? What do you do?
So I basically went from writing to editing. So I edit other folks' writing and help them come up with good topics to write about.
So this is actually an interesting point, and I think it goes to that word retirement. You know, you include it in the title here, the financial independence, or the FIRE community, financial independence, retire early. I think that one of the biggest strawmen in the room is like what that definition of retirement actually means to many of us. And I doubt that you actually feel retired, but I would imagine at the same time, you also kind of feel like you've claimed that mantle as well, and that you're doing what you want, not because of the money. The money that you're receiving from the podcast, the money that you're receiving from Forbes probably doesn't change your life in any dramatic way at this particular point in time, but you're doing it in spite of the money, I guess. And then I'm curious for you, what does retirement mean to you?
Yeah. So when I sold Dough Roller, my thinking was I'm really retired. I'll make a little bit of money doing the podcast, but I need to figure out how I'm going to spend and draw down my nest egg. I would have gone with a bucket strategy of sorts was my plan. I'll be honest. You know, I was, I guess, 51, I think, when I saw, I look much, much older, but I'm 53 now.
I wouldn't have guessed a year over 52.
Thank you for that. I was scared to death to start spending the money. You know, people talk about that, you know, and people, you know, I don't know how people at 40 with exactly 25 times their annual expenses do it. I was scared to death at 51, and we have more than 25 times our annual expenses, but I was going to do it and use a bucket strategy. But then when the Forbes opportunity came along, it's certainly, as you might imagine, far less money than I would make, let's say, practicing law, for example. But it's enough to live on. We don't live month to month an expensive lifestyle. We're not cutting the budget to the bone, but it's enough to live on. So I haven't had to draw down any of our investments. They just, other than taxes and charity, I haven't spent a nickel of the money I got from the sale. It's just sitting in index funds doing its thing.
You know, as we get ready to go into the hot seat, I kind of want to point out something. It's that you've kind of taken this non-traditional approach to retirement that I think is reflected in our own lives. Retirement is not the do nothing or spend more time on even the country club or whatever. It's just like a life that's based on, you know, what you get to design it. You get to do whatever you want with the best decades of your life. What do you want to do? Let's do more of that. I'm curious if you're going to challenge, you know, definitions. One of the things that we kind of talk about a lot is the importance of hitting that 50% savings rate. You made this when we were talking offline, you made this point that you wanted to address. Why those who claim you need to save 50% of their income in order to reach financial independence are dead wrong. That to me is one of those things that I just can't let, I got to hear the answer. What are your thoughts on that? How, you're challenging the 50% savings rate.
Yeah, it's just math. I mean, the book, although it sounds like an early retirement book, honestly, it's not. It certainly gives you the math, but I'm not pushing early retirement in the sense of save 25 times and then stop doing anything that earns an income. But when you look at the math and how long it takes you to get to 25 times your expenses, the greater percentage of your income that you can save, you know, the faster you'll get there, right? Captain Obvious. But if you're out of college, let's say, and you want to retire by the time you're 50, certainly an early retirement, you know, 30% will probably do it. Right? Now, that's still a pretty solid savings rate, certainly by traditional standards, but it's not 50%. Of course, if you save 50%, you'll get there faster. But, you know, you can retire early if that's your goal, or achieve FI at an age that would be considered quite early, quite young, with a savings rate that's certainly far less than 50%.
Yeah, Rob, I completely agree. It is just math at the end of the day. I think here at Choose FI, we like to use that 50% as an anchor point. And clearly we say, even if you don't hit it, even if you get to 30%, 25%, you're still doing dramatically better than the common advice. But I think we love to use that as just the background anchor point. It is a timeline. You're going to get there. So yeah, I like that explanation for sure.
Well, and there's another important thing to keep in mind is in the book, you know, and as you guys describe it, you make these assumptions. Well, what if you save this or that percent? But of course, that's not how life works, right? Life isn't so smooth. It's lumpy. And so when you start out, you might be saving 2.3% or 8% or whatever. And it's going to change over time. It's going to change when you're saving for a house. It's probably going to change when you have children. And so it's not going to be just one thing. And at least that's been our experience. And sometimes we've saved 70% of our income. But yeah, I think 50%, boy, I think that's an admirable goal for sure. But yeah, you certainly don't have to hit that mark, even if you want to achieve FI at a relatively young age.
So retire before mom and dad, mentioned the name of the book here, just because you do have kids. And I'm curious, you know, you've dedicated so much of your life to these ideas. Have you seen them latch hold of them? Are they as excited or on the path to being as excited about these ideas as you are?
You know, this was a friendly interview until you asked that question.
We're definitely
keeping this in. I love our children. They both have strengths and weaknesses. I think their approach to money is a work in progress. and I'm working with them. In fact, I just had breakfast with our son, who works here in Northern Virginia and is a Marine, and love him to death, and working on some personal finance questions. He had some healthcare questions, which health plan to get. You know, he's doing good, saving in his 401k. I think they could both use some help on the spending side of the equation. Of course, when I was their age, I needed some help in that department too.
Life is lumpy. All right, Rob, on most shows, that would be the end of the episode. But on this show, we would love to give you the chance to tackle the hot seat. Are you ready for this?
I'm not sure. I'll let you know.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption, trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation, these questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
All right, Rob, question number one. What is your favorite blog, podcast, or book of all time?
Wow. My favorite of all time.
All time.
You know, I'll give one that had, that I alluded to earlier. I don't know if I would describe it as my favorite, but it had a big influence on my life as an investor. And that was Rick Ferry's Asset Allocation. And I think it's probably, although it's been over a decade since I've read it, I think it's as applicable today as it was then.
All right. Question number two, an inflection point in your life that was especially memorable or meaningful?
Well, the death of my father. He died when I was 12. He was in a car accident. He was 39. And as you can imagine, that has a big impact on a kid. And I'm 53 and it still affects me today. I mean, in some ways it made me stronger. In some ways it helped me help other people who are going through similar losses. But yeah, that was a big moment in my life.
I can imagine. Question number three, your favorite life hack.
So my favorite life hack has to do with how I plan my day. And it's a simple one. There's 1,000 things to do every day in your work, in your personal life. I come up with the absolute 3 most important things that I need to do the next day to move my personal life, my business life, my health, working out, whatever, forward in a positive direction. So I come up with the big 3 and, those are my primary focus for the next day.
Wow, that's really cool. How many years have you been doing that?
Not long at all. I mean, I've done it in different forms for a long time, but recently I've started actually writing them on an index card, one index card for every day. And then I also track other things on that index card, like health related. Sometimes I'll just use it for notes for the day, but tracking the 3 on an index card so I don't forget them from the previous night.
All right, Rob, question number 4, your biggest financial mistake.
Well, there are several to choose from, but the biggest one would be joining the country club. I paid $70,000.
Oh.
Plus, and this was in 2001.
That's just the invitation to be able to play there, right? I mean, there's still annual fees.
Thank you for pointing that out. Yes, that's correct. I mean, you ask for the dumbest. I mean, that's pretty stupid. Yeah.
And what sort of world is that an aspirational goal? Like, I mean, honestly, like it's okay. All right.
No, that's a good question. And whatever world that is, I no longer inhabit it. Nice.
Question number five, the advice you would give your younger self.
The advice I would give my younger self, and here I'm thinking when I moved to DC and became a lawyer, and it is, don't move somewhere where the commute's going to be an hour and 15 minutes each way.
Even if you can listen to podcast?
even if I could listen to podcasts, although I hate to tell you, but back then I don't think they had podcasts. But yeah, we lived in North Arlington, and I was like four metro stops from my office. And then we move out to the Burke Annandale area in Northern Virginia, and I'm an hour and 15, hour and a half commute each way. I mean, it's life changing in a very negative way.
Going the wrong way. Yeah, absolutely.
Rob, we've got a bonus question for you. What's the purchase that you've made in, let's say, the last 12 months or so that has added the most value to your life?
These are kind of tough questions. I don't...
It's a hot seat, man. Come on.
It is a hot seat. I feel very warm. Can I kind of reverse the question and tell you one thing that I got rid of?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I like that.
Okay. So my car. You know, husband and wife, they have two cars. That's just what you do here in America. But I thought, well, what if, I don't know, what if I got rid of my car? Well, what travesty would befall us? So I got rid of the car in July. I bike to the gym. I bike to the coffee shop if I go there. I bike to the grocery store. We live in a biker-friendly neighborhood area, so that's good. And it's been tremendous. It's one less thing to deal with. Obviously, it saves us a lot on money. Could I get another car someday? I might. You never know. But so far, I don't miss it one bit.
Let's talk about what if, just for a second. Let's play that out a little bit here. What's the exercise that someone can use to challenge maybe something they've taken for granted?
Yeah. So, and this came up as I was trying to get rid of expenses 15 years ago. You would hold on to things. Well, I can't get rid of that. Life just won't have the same meaning if I don't go to Starbucks every day, or more importantly, maybe if I don't have this gym membership, or if I don't have this second car or whatever it is. And I thought, well, you know, why is that? Maybe that's not the case. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe what I think is making me happy and giving life meaning, really, that's just not true. I just believe that because habit, routine, whatever. And so I started challenging some of those beliefs, and I would do what if questions. Well, what if I didn't have this, or what if I didn't do that? And I looked for ways to run experiments. So, you know, in the case of the car, I got rid of our car, or my car. You know, if it didn't work out, I'll buy another car. That's okay. Not the end of the world. But I started asking the what if questions to help me think outside the box. You know, what if I got rid of my car? And then immediately you have an objection. Well, I can't get rid of my car. How am I going to get to work? Well, what if you asked your boss if you could work at home? Well, he or she's not going to allow that. Well, what if you got a new job? Well, you know, you could just continue to go, what if you move? Now, you may get to the end of all of these what if questions and decide, nope, yeah, I still need my car. I'm going to keep it. That's fine. But at least you've gone through the exercise that's allowed you to challenge convention and challenge your own limiting thoughts and think outside the box. At the end of the day, you may stick with whatever decision you've already made. That's okay. But I think a lot of times you may find that, no, you might be willing to experiment. Maybe I'll go without my mocha every day, which is what I did many years ago, and don't miss it now. It killed me for the first 2 weeks, by the way. But when I got past the 14 or 21 day mark, I didn't miss it. So yeah, I kind of combine what if questions with life experiments. And the most recent one for me is going without a car.
Awesome. All right. Well, again, for our audience, the book is Retire Before Mom and Dad. And Rob, for people that want to find out more about the book, they want to purchase it, or they want to find out more about you and your story, where can they find you?
So retirebeforemomanddad.com is, I think, the primary place. And I do still write for Forbes, even though I do most of my work there editing. But you can follow me over at Forbes, too, if you want to.
Rob, thanks so much for joining us on the show. This has been a blast.
Thanks, guys. It's been a lot of fun.
All right, my friends, if you got value from today's episode, and if you've been getting value from the episodes up to this point, just take 1 second and press the subscribe button on the platform you're listening to this on. Just lets the providers know you're getting value from the show and you want to be here when we produce additional content. If you want to support us and what we're doing here at Choose FI, here are 4 easy ways. 1, leave us an iTunes review. To do that, just go to choosefi.com/iTunes. 2, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to choosefi.com/cards and get started today. 3, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free and just go to choosefi.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in cat. And 4, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 100. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth, one life hack at a time.